welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is December 20th, 2022. And this is episode 360. It's our end of the year, end of 2022 episode. I'm the ghost, Mark Ames, battling. I got a little virus war going on in my head. Up here in Rochester, New York, and I'm on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the War Nerd. Interest. John, are you healthy? Are you healthier than I am?
Well, I had the sutures out from my messed up mouth today, and that went well enough. I'm not bleeding or anything. So, yeah, I mean, you get old, you got to reduce your expectations, but I'm not grotesquely unhealthy at the moment, which is the best you can say. I'm just sad to be leaving Trieste. I mean, it's not like we're leaving yet. We're here for another 3 weeks.
And sad in advance, as Svetlana would say, right?
Exactly. I'm really sad in advance because I haven't loved any place as much as I love this place in quite a while. And it's also going to be the solstice. And I always feel that you should celebrate the solstice, but I never know how. People burn things and such, but I feel like doing something that is whatever the opposite of burning something is. And I can't really do that. So I don't know. But it has to
planting
be marked
a seed?
Somehow. I guess it would be like that. Yeah. On the seventh floor, that doesn't work so much. And what I have been doing is feeding these gigantic seagulls, because we're right on the sea here, and these gigantic pterodactyl seagulls come around in the morning, and I put out some food for them on the window ledge on this seventh, or by American terms, eighth floor window. And they really love it. And what's amazing, considering they're seagulls, they're not crows, they're not geniuses, they're dummies, but they really do their best. Like, originally they would take their gigantic, you know, mountain climbing hammer beaks and hammer on the windows.
Wow.
But they realized that kind of annoyed us. We would sort of gesture at them to go away. And now Catherine was sitting in a chair by the window recently, and this gull was going, tap, 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 tap. It was very touching.
Yeah. Maybe they're not so dumb. I mean, crows are on a different level. I guess crows and a few others like parrots and stuff. But I don't know. They're pretty fierce. I think I talked about this before. There was this really cool, I don't know how you'd call it, like a multimedia rendering of some book about these refugees from Afghanistan, these two brothers who went through hell as migrants in Europe. And at one point, and it's all done on this rotating wheel with music, sound, voiceover, and then models. And you just sit there with your eyes right up against the window, you know, watching each new phase of this big wheel of models coming at you. And towards the end, when they tried to cross from France to Britain, the French border police are represented as seagulls. And they're really terrifying. And they're really horrible and terrifying. And I kind of thought, yeah, they're pretty fierce. I mean,
yeah,
they eat a lot of things and kill a lot of things. They're fierce. Ask
they'll
pigeons.
They'll eat anything. Yes.
Yeah.
And those beaks are powerful. I was starting to wonder, before they developed tact, I was starting to wonder if they'd break the windows.
Right. So here we are, John. It's the end of 2022.
Yeah.
And, you know, as warriors go, for better and for worse, well, for worse and for worse, the worse, as we would say, you know, it's been quite a war year.
I was looking over our episodes, though, and I have to say we did a pretty good job of covering things. I mean, we started out the year with a pretty important episode on the Civil War, I think, because it was the one that saying Buchanan was a traitor.
He wasn't, I love that episode. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And then we started talking to Joshua Landis about the Syria war, and we were covering the Ukraine war pretty steadily. We had that great interview with an American Ukrainian who escaped from Kyiv.
Yeah, right after. Yeah.
Yeah. Then you went into your Chechen Wars series, which really, really explained a lot. And I think a lot of people learned from that one. Mm-hmm. And we continued the Civil War. We had that great show with Seth Harp.
Yes. Seth Harp, the journalist from Harper's, who went out to Kyiv and to report on the International Legion, and is really one of the rare Western journalists who was questioning things, questioning where is power here, what's really going on, without being like a Putin lover by any stretch. That's how it is these days in journalism. You either love one side or love the other. But he actually did his job. That was a great interview. Yeah.
And we did a series on the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, which was pretty remarkable, because one constant that we see here is Turkey gets a pass.
Yeah.
There was a time when people in the know said, oh, Israel gets a pass. But those days are sort of gone.
Yeah.
The U.S. ally who gets a pass now is Turkey by far.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad we did that, because Turkey just kept coming up so much in everything, in so many stories, usually in very malign ways, whether in Artsakh war or in Syria or historically. And it was time that we started to get to understand how Turkey operates and how the U.S.-Turkey relationship operates. And we're getting closer to understanding that, I think.
We've done some good hardware shows, because things got pretty kinetic this year. For example, we did a show on drone wars in Ukraine with Samuel Bendett, who was a good interview and explained a lot of things. We tried to get into the tactical nukes question, when that was going to be a big issue, and
still might be.
And then we finished the year with that excellent series with Ryan Gingeras on the end of the Ottomans and the beginning of the Kemalite era in Turkey, which explains a lot, especially about the ferocity and single-mindedness of the Turkish state, which has been a feature of the whole experience of the last century, and because the state has existed for almost exactly a century.
Yeah, and also helps explain why Turkey is trying to, I mean, why it's in their interest, let's say, why they believe it's in their interest, and what the historical precedent is for why Turkey is trying to sort of play both sides in the Ukraine war, being, practical / friendly with both Russia and with Ukraine, and of course its NATO allies, but also being a pain in the ass to its NATO allies, who are sort of caught between trying to push Turkey to be a better team player, a better NATO team player, without losing Turkey, without completely alienating Turkey. I mean, it's a very tense relationship, that goes back, it has been for a long time, but neither side wants to break it. And there's always that sort of, they've come to that precipice several times. I mean, that's one of the stories that came out in the Turkish War in Cyprus episodes, the different times that like LBJ threatened Turkey if they invaded Cyprus, and Turkey didn't, and Turkey didn't leave NATO either.
Yeah.
And eventually Turkey got what it wanted, so northern Cyprus, well, half of Cyprus, basically.
Yeah, and in many wars recently, it's been sort of an alliance between NATO proper and Turkey and the U.S., Israel, a lot of countries that are very well connected, and the UK, versus some remnant of the mostly massacred minority populations of the inland Middle East, the Armenians, the Kurds, what's left of the Assyrians. You would think Armenia in particular, as the tiny remnant of a mostly genocided people, would get some consideration in world opinion. But there's absolutely no hint of that. Turkey is more important. Turkey is now sponsoring Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan has oil and money to spare, and therefore...
And a border with Iran.
Yeah.
Plays, you know, hosts Israeli intelligence for whatever operation, and CIA and whoever else on that border.
So there's been absolutely no hint that, you know, there would be a certain degree of sympathy for Armenia. As we record this show, as far as I know, the roads into Nagorno-Karabakh, what's left of it, are being blockaded. And
the Lechin corridor.
Yeah, there is, as usual, a complete news blackout on that. And that was the other big story of the, well, not just the year, but the last few years, Tigray. I would say that since it's unlikely that 200,000 Ukrainians have died of starvation yet, they may yet, who knows. But that has happened already in Tigray.
At least, I'm trying to be conservative here.
That has happened. It's hard to say, really, because not only has the Ethiopian government cut all means of communication with Tigray, but and the Eritrean government, but there isn't the will to find out in most Western media, so we'll never know. There's been this peace agreement since 2nd November 2022, but it's clearly not being followed by either of the governments who have the power, the Eritrean or the Ethiopian government, or it's being followed as slowly and grudgingly as possible. And beyond that, as I said, there's not the will in the international community, such as it is, to push against those governments. And in the process, this might be one of those moments where everybody looks away, because they have looked away from Tigray to the extent that they looked at it at all. They looked away once Ukraine started. And in the process, I don't know, a really promising, really beautiful part of the world might end up destroyed.
Yeah, when you think of, well, first of all, before I even move away from Ethiopia, I just wanted to say that it seems that Eritrea is kind of willingly playing more bad cop in this kind of semi-ceasefire that's going on to Ethiopia, sort of trying to, mollify some criticism that it's getting. Because Ethiopia has a lot of other, you know, pots in the fire right now. I mean, it has a whole bunch of insurgencies that it's also dealing with. And Eritrea doesn't care in the same degree about criticism.
Yeah, but I mean, when you isolate a country, you obviously reduce your leverage with it. Right. And Eritrea has been isolated for a long time, to the point that the only really employment around is with the security agencies. Everybody who's interested in working in a more productive capacity has either left or given up. And there's not much anybody could do about Eritrea short of an invasion.
But one other thing I've noticed too, John, when you talk about, you know, watching the media for Tigray stories, and also watching the media, as I have for Armenia, Artsakh, Nagorno-Karabakh war stories this year, there's completely ignoring, which we saw most starkly, I think, with the Yemen story, just ignoring, you know, mass death, hundreds of thousands of children through an artificial famine imposed by U.S.-backed forces. Then there is something that's kind of like a very occasional concern. It's almost like getting planting an alibi or something.
Yeah, what can we do? Right.
Yeah,
there are so many what can we do stories.
And like, you know, we held talks or we did. But
yeah.
I mean, we know what the state is capable of, the U.S. in particular, what it is capable of organizing when it cares. It's capable of moving mountains, you know. It may not be capable of winning wars, but it's definitely capable of, you know, strong arming and organizing its allies and huge amounts of money and resources and weapons and so on when it cares. Yeah. So what you see in Ethiopia is, you know, the occasional condemnation or the occasional expression of concern, the occasional, you know, we need to get humanitarian aid in. But and we see something like this in Nagorno-Karabakh recently. So right now, Azerbaijan, which is run by, you know, one of the most corrupt authoritarian dictatorships in the world, but that happens to supply oil and gas to the EU and happens to wet a lot of important beaks in Washington and London, so it doesn't get demonized in the same way. They have, they've imposed a blockade on the remaining ethnic Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh that haven't been cleansed. And you're seeing, you know, the EU saying you've got to back up, like making statements saying we're going to get involved. And even, you know, some U.S. officials saying this is not right. You need to not do this. It comes out tiny amounts as if there's an alibi there, but it's not backed by anything real whatsoever.
No, right.
Because yeah. Armenia, you know, it's Azerbaijan carries a lot of water in Washington and London, and Armenia doesn't carry shit. I take it back. It does have a strong lobby, but it doesn't enrich people there. That's the problem.
No, in fact, I thought there would be a stronger push from the Armenian diaspora, and there really hasn't been. They've been ineffective. I admit I was surprised by that. I thought they had power in D.C., but... what do I know about D.C.? Clearly, they don't. And Turkey is big. Turkey is really big.
And Israel. I mean, when you put those two together,
It's
like Wonder Twins unite.
It's hopeless. And they're very much together. Turkey's flagship war product, the Bayraktar armed drone, was used very effectively in the beginning of the second Nagorno-Karabakh war, and so were Israeli drones. They were both there, and the United States was cheering this moment of sort of what you might call the greater NATO, the greater cartel, whatever you want to call it. And everybody was on board, and it was a charming moment, except that this moment was at the expense of some of the survivors of one of the most ruthlessly genocided peoples of the 20th century. And that was not a convenient fact for anybody, so it just sort of didn't get mentioned.
Yeah, it's very depressing. They don't have much friend. They have Russia as a friend, which isn't much
of
a friend.
No,
I mean, that's all they got. And sort
but
Iran.
It's like, Russia and Iran, oh, great. The cartel is really going to be sympathetic to you when you've got those for
exactly.
friends.
But of course, they're the only ones who will be friends. You
Absolutely.
Force them to make them your friends, and then you say, oh, we'd love to help you, but you're friends with bad guys. You know?
Yeah.
They're screwed. And again, one of the things about Pashinyan, the prime minister who took over in that pro-democracy revolution 2018, it turned out to be a really impressive guy. You know, he screwed up in getting into the war. He screwed up in allowing the 2020 war to happen and thinking it wouldn't be a disaster. He was young, he was a novice, and he wasn't there as, he wasn't from like his world was not all about nationalism and the war. His world was about democratizing and society there and appealing to the youth of Armenia. But he screwed up big time. And then he acknowledged it. That's what I found the most amazing thing. He gave this incredible speech last year to the Armenian people. He announced elections and said, I screwed up. And here's the reality of our situation. And you guys decide, because I came to power, you know, promising to democratize this country more. And the reality is we lost the war and we have no friends. And Azerbaijan has all the friends in Europe, despite all the kind, you know, big fancy words out of France and out of Brussels and out of Washington. We have no friends. We lost the war. Azerbaijan is richer and Azerbaijan has all the big friends. We have to accept this reality and make whatever wretched peace deal we have to conserve what we have. Acknowledging this reality or commit suicide acknowledging this reality, but don't pretend like it's not true. And
that really is amazing. Yeah, that's magnificent. And yeah, and meanwhile, everybody's watching Elon Musk do this sort of slapstick goof version of that. Like, do you want me to quit it? Oh, God. Yeah. It's funny. The world kind of doesn't want to watch the few truly heroic stories out there. It's much more interested in the goof stories. But let's get to the big goof of of the past couple of years anyway. That is the one that the story that everybody was following to the exclusion of these stories. And that would be our friend Ukraine, which we've covered really well. And
after getting it wrong, after getting the
invasion
wrong.
Well, yeah, but there was a New York Times story. Yeah, New York Times story very recently showing that even at the highest levels of the Russian state, that is everybody who wasn't allowed in the room with Putin while his brain was festering, they all said, no, this is not going to happen. Nope.
Yeah, it was one of those extremely rare moments when only the most horrible people called it right. Only the most corrupt, wretched neocons, Atlantic counselors, career Russia threat inflationers, arms industry tools, those people. I mean, the only one who called it right in a kind of calm, even way, who I you have to respect just as somebody who's researched this region for a while and read some of his stuff, is the current CIA chief, Bill Burns, who used to be a diplomat and wrote some great cables that were released by secret cables that, you know, were leaked by WikiLeaks, which are very prescient. I mean, among the cables he wrote when he was an ambassador out there, Burns, who's current CIA chief, back in 2008 was, if we get too close to Ukraine, if we make NATO membership a real thing, be advised that they have made it clear every which way that this is a red line that will result in war. And he warned that over and over. That's the current CIA chief. Of course, then after the fact, all the Michael McFalls and all these people said, this has nothing to do with NATO and everything to do with punishing a Jeffersonian democracy because they can't handle democracy on their board, blah, blah, blah. You know, and he was saying, you know, to the extent a CIA chief can say anything and can be trusted. I mean, the CIA's job is to lie. I mean, so I don't fault myself for thinking Burns must be spewing some weird CIA stuff, because the CIA's job is usually to lie and sometimes tell you the truth, I guess. Sometimes tell their leaders the truth, maybe.
Yeah.
But usually it's to lie and deceive.
Well, what strikes me is that maybe he was writing that as a warning, although who knows? Again, he's the CIA chief, and maybe he didn't mean it as a warning, but
he was relating what he was hearing and being told.
But I mean, what I'm saying here is the new, very warlike, centrist Democratic Party, which is very tight with the defense industry, and we're going to talk about the defense budget later in the show. They may not have interpreted that as a warning at all, but so Russia will go to war in a doomed cause in Ukraine, and we have cannon fodder in the Ukrainians who will really fight and let us test out some new muscles and missiles, for that matter. Mm-hmm. And great, you know, great.
Yeah. And I mean, looking back in a dark, cold, cynical way, that's why you do nurture nationalist, hardcore Ukrainian nationalist extremists. You know, everyone's wring their hands. Why would the West allow and train up, you know, people with SS Wolfsangel patches in the uniform? Why would we allow that? You know, we're supposed to be promoting democracy. These people are spreading hate. Well, it's like, well, because they will fight and kill the people who fight and kill our local adversaries. And, you know, that's empire.
Oh, you had a great story before the show about the Azov Battalion visiting Israel.
Yeah, it's I don't know even what to say, man. It's the Azov Battalion sent some people to Israel to visit Masada and do photo ops from Masada. And literally, the guy has a Wolfsangel patch. They didn't even hide it. He's got a Wolfsangel, an SS fucking Nazi patch, right there on top of Masada, and everyone's like, yeah, this is great. And there's a Jerusalem Post article which tries to quote, it finds different people to say, it's always like, well, yes, they had a neo-Nazi pass, but that changed in 2014. The next guy, that changed in 2016. The next guy, well, in 2019, they definitely got rid of their Nazis. And then there's a photo of a guy with a Wolfsangel patch on Masada. And, you know, I mean, what can you say? Like, they don't care, obviously. Yeah. You know, it's Israel, I mean, there were articles that came out earlier, I think Electric Intifada or some others, wrote about some years ago about how Israel was arming and training some members of the Azov Battalion. And Azov's, despite their, you know, Banderite history, their primary, I mean, they exterminated the Jews. They got rid of most of them. And there's some still there, but their primary enemy are not Jews. And they're flexible. They can make friends with Jews too. Their primary enemy are Russians, ethnic Russians.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to repeat a quote, but there is that amazing ditty that Limonov said he grew up hearing from the people who lived in the villages around Kharkiv, which was, into Muscovite, which I assume was Moscow. Polak and Jew, take your knife and stick it through. I mean, there's a big list of enemies. And at one point, enemies can change. Obviously, Moscow is at the, but you know, Moscow Zhid, I guess, which used to be the old.
Zhid of Moscow, Zhid of Bolshevik,
that's been dropped. Because
mostly. People, not completely, right, well, though. There's a lot of it. I mean, if you remember Natalia Savenko, who was the hero of the Western media, won a Freedom Award from Atlantic Council. Madeleine Albright, author of a book on fascism, personally awarded her when she got out of the Russian prison. She was, you know, a freedom fighter against Russian invaders in 2014, jailed by the Russians. And as soon as she got out of jail and picked up her awards in Brussels and Washington and elsewhere, she entered the political scene and said, the problem are Jews in this country. And we have to, Jews are the problem over and over until finally people said, wow, this is a problem. And they stopped talking about what a hero she is and moved on to the next Nazi. Really, there's a lot of it. There's a lot of it because they're very useful for exactly what we're dealing with today. It is not all Ukrainians. It's not most Ukrainians. It's not a majority of Ukrainians. But it is a very influential, powerful, well-backed and armed and organized minority of Ukrainians whose usefulness has now come to the fore. It answers the question, why? Why did we back these guys?
Right. Well,
because they fight. Kill.
Well, now let's try to sum up what happened this year in the war in Ukraine. And I know you've got a really good idea that
I have an angle on this that, I mean, I guess we could talk about the overall picture. And then I want to talk about my angle on this because the New York Times came out with a very interesting piece, interesting in the good sense and in the usual hack bad sense, a few days ago called How Putin's War Became a Catastrophe. You know, and we're I mean, we agree it's a catastrophe. We've mm-hmm. been saying this all along. I know there's this.
No, I think for me, one of the big lessons of this whole episode was, I mean, I was committing what mm-hmm. you could call, if you like, a logical fallacy. I don't much believe in logical fallacies when attempting to predict human conduct. But anyway, this doesn't make any sense. And mm-hmm. my conclusion was, therefore, it won't happen. There's a problem with that. A lot of things that don't make any sense happen because mm-hmm. Countries get controlled by people who have lost it in the meantime. You know, Napoleon deciding to invade Russia, that didn't make any sense, especially let's invade Russia as a way of showing England how dangerous we are, as opposed to just building a bunch of flatboats with oars and just sailing over there. But anyway, but it happened, and it destroyed the most impressive army in the history of Europe. And invading Ukraine didn't make sense either, but that didn't mean it wasn't going to happen. So, yeah.
Well, but also part of this logical fallacy, I guess, is X has an identifiable pattern of not doing really stupid, crazy things. This would be stupid and crazy. Therefore, X, who has no history really of that, won't do that.
Yeah.
But that is to say Putin or Napoleon or something. But Putin did something that you know, I don't think it was crazy. I don't think it was irrational, but I you know, he was being provoked and so on, but it was really stupid and based on some really bad assumptions, the main one being that you know, that Russia could win a quick lightning strike war by quickly overwhelming and subduing Kyiv. That just completely misunderstood Ukrainians and how Ukrainians would fight, and I think was based completely on bad intelligence and the experience in 2014, well, especially early 2015, late 2014, when the Ukrainians, aside from maybe a few of these far-right volunteer battalions, really, like their armed forces really did fight very poorly. But that was before, you know, 7 years of NATO training and indoctrination and time to build up a real hatred for the enemy that's invaded and taken some of your territory.
Yeah, and another factor that was stressed in the New York Times version, something that we've been talking about all along, was the degree to which Putin believed his own yes men when they mm-hmm. said the Russian military has been completely transformed. This is a new model army that will just rip through Ukraine like the proverbial knife through butter. That was a lie. Mm-hmm. And they seem to stress, and we've heard a lot of people say this, that Putin has, I mean, his caution was transforming into something verging on paranoia, partly triggered by the pandemic. I don't know if that part is true.
The part that's mushy, right? I mean, I've kind of said this too, that he got more isolated. You know, the way that the New York Times says this is like, it's almost like he got in these sort of radicalized in feedback loops the way people do on YouTube or social media. I've felt this, but it's mushy thinking. Like there's nothing substantive about saying that. It's just a hunch, you know, that we have. Having watched him over the years and seeing the way his delivery changed. Now, again, but this is like body language reading and psychologizing. It's mushy thinking. It's an observation I make, but I wouldn't stake my what little money I have on it or whatever. But they certainly do. I mean, there's that great New York Times line is, this is a classic New York Times hackery, you know, some reported with concern that, quote, Putin's got this warlike twinkle in his eyes. That's my favorite line.
We used to call this a catachresis in rhetoric. It's like warlike twinkle. That's if anything, it's a little too 20th century in its catachresal nature. But it's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, name of figure of speech is Flynn. Catachresis. Again, the war, you know, the invasion was launched in February 23rd. It was a massive invasion from several different points, from the south all the way up to the north. The key one, which was the invasion from Belarus into Belarus and sort of two major thrusts, one to Chernihiv, which was probably more of a diversion, but a major thrust to take Kyiv. And Kyiv is only 55 miles, as I said, from the Belarus border. And as this report points out, and we've been saying, and, you know, I think it's pretty damn clear, I mean, the initial war plan was to so overwhelm a fractured, which was true, a fractured Ukraine and what they thought was going to be easy to overwhelm Ukraine. It's overwhelmed Kyiv that the central authorities would either flee, and the U.S. was talking about trying to evacuate Zelensky, if you remember, like right up to the invasion, and he didn't leave, which was very smart. So they would either capture him or force him out, put in some puppet ruler and force them to come to some sort of humiliating agreement. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of questions about, and then what? I mean, look at Iraq, right? And then what? Yeah. But that was the plan, and a pretty dumb plan, and sort of, you know, backup plan. Plan B after that was, oh, shit, it turns out they do fight well. What do we do now? And ever since then, there's been a series of retrenchments by the Russian side. I guess you'd say phase two of this war, which was, I guess, sort of mid-late April until mid-late August, was when Russia focused the war much more on the south, on Donbas, and on securing Mariupol. And they took the rest of Luhansk region when they took Severodonetsk and Lysychansk. And then, and that was clearly a very bloody phase for both the Russian side and the Ukrainian side. But in that meantime, the Ukrainians, who did a mass mobilization, you know, men weren't allowed to leave. There were a lot of stories that came out early on, but those stories stopped about males being sort of rounded up by Ukrainian border guards and press ganged into the service. But that mistakenly gave Russians the impression that Ukrainian morale was low. It wasn't low. During that time, the Ukrainians trained up huge new pools of units, reserves, everything, and got huge amounts of weapons and were trained up in the much better weapons from the West. And whereas the Russians their forces were depleted, to the point where, certainly up in the north in the Kharkiv region, I mean, the ratio of people of soldiers or military people holding to the amount of territory they were holding was absurd. And Ukraine started its big counteroffensive in the Kherson region. It was bloody. They didn't really go anywhere, but they did draw away even more forces from the north. And then they moved everything up north and just cut through what few Russian forces were up there, like the proverbial knife through butter, and took huge swaths of territory up in the north. And that led to, I guess, eventually phase three, which started, I guess, around the end of September. We talked about some of this with Yasha Levine, who was there during Putin's call to mobilize hundreds of thousands of new Russian recruits. The mobilization order went out. Some of those are already at the front. And in phase three, and he appointed a new general Armageddon Surovikin, who at least thus far, I ain't gonna do any predictions here. Thus far has clearly proven to be more realistic and more, pragmatic than predecessors. And that just may be because Putin has finally had to realize, Putin's dictatorial control over things is pretty serious. Like that, that came out on the eve of the invasion in February when he brought his, the Siloviki leaders and before him, different sort of intelligence and military chiefs, asking them, basically to read off a script on what they should, on what Russia should do in terms of invading to, invading Ukraine to denazify, whatever. And he treated all of them like children. I mean, it was brutal. And so that's a leader who everyone was scared to tell bad news to. Everyone was scared of getting in trouble with. But eventually reality seems to have caught up with them. So they've shortened the front. They wound up giving up huge amounts of territory in the Kherson region, including the capital Kherson. And they moved behind the Dnieper River to the left bank. And that's kind of where we are right now. I mean, there's this meter by meter battle going on for Bakhmut. That seems to be one of the main battles that everyone's focused on. But that's been going on for 5 or 6 months now. And this is Wagner Group's signature battle. And it's, I would say they're probably going to take Bakhmut. It's a small town. I don't know what it does for Russia of taking it. I think it helps probably Wagner Group some. I put it this way, if Wagner can't ever take it, it hurts Prigozhin's prestige to some degree. If they take it, taking anything has a psychological effect of one sort or another, but it's not like, on a larger war level, like taking Bakhmut means, it's not like Stalingrad or something where everything turns around.
Well, I think the turn in the war, and it was a pretty dramatic turn, has led to a lot of stories that I'm not quite sure how to take, like the Ukrainian government making noises about claiming Crimea. And my guess would be, and you tell me, that would not be so easy. Who knows? I mean, the Russian forces have been pretty bad so far, but I don't know. Maybe they would fight better in Crimea.
I can't believe they would give up Crimea without going all the way. But again, this war has been the graveyard of predictions. I'm not going to predict.
Yeah.
Who knows where they're going to be 6 months from now? I mean, each side thinks they're wearing the other side down. Mm-hmm. One thing we've seen in the war, so in the very, very beginning, when the war first happened, intelligence got a lot of things wrong. And the think tankers who got the scale of the invasion more or less right got wrong was that they thought Russia was going to sweep all the way through and go right into Moldova and threaten, either one or more of the Baltics and maybe even Poland. If you remember, that was the kind of crazy talk. That was even coming out of U.S. intelligence too.
So
that was wrong, and we don't talk about that. That was one of many things they got wrong.
Well, what's interesting to me, because I'm trying to link this to the U.S. defense budget, which just came out recently, is what you don't hear is, wait a minute, we're paying $1 trillion a year, mostly out of fear of this army, which couldn't take Kyiv. Yeah. That's kind of ridiculous. The estimates of the Russian army have been scaled down radically, but somehow that doesn't affect the U.S. defense budget at all.
Yeah, I mean, so when it was clear that the Russian invasion looked like a complete mess and some very elite units were getting just wiped out, coordination was terrible. I mean, look, the Russian military fought very well, impressed and kind of shocked, I think, a lot of Westerners, the way it fought pretty well in Syria, because that was supposed to be their Vietnam and quagmire, if you remember the talk coming out of Washington when that first happened. And so I guess my point is that, you know, Russia has been fighting poorly in this war on every level, from planning, execution, everything. But that doesn't mean in a different kind of war it wouldn't fight a lot better. We don't know. Yeah. But in this war, it's definitely done things like mind-bogglingly bad, poorly. When things started going, when it became clear after a few weeks, after, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, that Russia wasn't getting what it wanted, that a lot of them were being killed, that their units were suffering, were being wiped out, and so on. And then when Russia started really pulling back and basically abandoning and retreating from huge areas that it had initially taken, that was the first wave of talk out of Washington, London, Ukraine. Oh, we're not just going to defeat Russia. Russia is a complete paper tiger. They're a joke. The question is, do we stop at taking Ukraine, or are we going to go all the way to Moscow? Are we going to decolonize Russia and liberate, you know, Bashkiria, Tatarstan, Tuva, or, you know, or will they be able to hold on? Like, all that decolonization talk started. Then that got stopped when Russia's, you know, second sort of, I guess, stage of the war wound up having some success, particularly taking, you know, Popasna and Severodonetsk and Lysychansk, and Ukraine was getting just ground in a mulch in May, June, and July. And you didn't hear any of that talk anymore about Russia being thrown back. And then after Ukraine, you know, after Russia collapsed in Kharkiv, and since then we've been hearing again the same talk. Ukraine can easily take Crimea. The only question is, did they take Rostov and Voronezh regions, or do they liberate Bashkiria and all the other colonized regions, you know, of Russia and decolonization?
I have to admit, I would love to see the liberation of Tuva. that would be hilarious. Like, yes. There'd be some great throat singing anthems to the Ukrainian brothers who've came to us across so many thousands of kilometers of taiga, but I think they might lose a few people along the way.
I know. Well, and there's something to the Tuva thing, actually. I don't think they talked about liberating Tuva. It was more like the Ukrainian nationalists to part of their sort of propaganda about the Russian invasion was that there are all these Tuvans, that is to say Mongols, that is to say Asiatics, who are raping our women and raping babies and killing, you know, old people and babies on bayonets. And they really use the Tuvans. And I think in part, if I'm not mistaken, in part because Sergei Shoigu, the defense minister, is part Tuvan. And then they would amplify any Tuvan that they could find in the military and just blow up a whole sort of narrative around that. But they were really talking, and I've seen these accounts and these people. It's sort of like captive nations, the sort of Cold War, you know, kind of crypto fascist former, you know, Nazi collaborator organizations that were sort of resettled in London and Washington, the Captive Nations Group and the Anti-Communist League and stuff. They're refashioning something like that, but with leftist academic language about decolonization.
Well, the interesting thing about that, in light of the Turkish connection that we've been talking about, is that I don't think these depopulating Slavic enclaves like Ukraine, and Ukraine is depopulating.
Hugely.
It's becoming an empty country. It wouldn't really benefit them, although it would benefit the people who are encouraging this kind of talk from them, that is D.C. and London. The people it would benefit, if it ever happened, would be the pan-Turanist ideologues who want all that lower part of Russia broken up so that a larger Turkish union could happen there. And that has real momentum. That has population, that has money, that has weapons, that has United States support. That could happen. But it would the people who released it under this delusion that they would benefit would not be very happy with it.
Yeah, but they think they would. I mean, their ideology, which is what allows them to fight, also leads them there. I mean, I've seen, pretty sure it was Budzinov, the GRU, the GUR, the military intelligence chief, who's very powerful. I think one of the two or three most powerful people in Ukraine now. I think he was one of the people who tweeted out one of these like revanchist nationalist maps that shows, you know, Ukraine retaking its ancient Rus territory, which includes, you know, which means liberating, as they would call it, big chunks of Western Russian territory. I mean, these people, you know, they're not totally rational. I mean, they have these dreams too. But yeah, their population has declined from, Ukraine's population has declined from, I think, about 52 million when the Soviet Union fell to, I don't know, it was like officially around 38, 39 million shortly after the Maidan Revolution, but then millions more emigrated west when they could. And then the war came, so millions more left. So, I mean, it could be a country of between 25 and 30 million right now from 52 million 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's really remarkable. That's a demographic collapse.
Yeah.
That's, I can't think of any recent European examples. I mean, Europe is always moaning about its birth rate, but you don't have that kind of sudden, complete demographic collapse.
But I want to get back here before we move on from Ukraine.
We need to talk about your Belarus connection.
Yeah, so, you know, reading this article about how Putin's war became a catastrophe, and one of the points that's just kind of thrown out there casually, as if it's a given, is, you know, Putin's whole war plan was to take Kyiv, the initial war plan, and that meant invading from Belarus, because the border of Belarus is only 50 miles away. It's so close. And I just, you know, we've forgotten, and they've forgotten, that it's never been a given that Russia could stage an invasion from Belarus. And that's not explored. I mean, all this, you know, the twinkle in his eyes explored, and the isolation and the body language. But this, I think, you know, what changed in the relationship between Russia and Belarus and Putin and Lukashenko is a much more material explanation that might explain why Putin thought now was a good time, now was a good opportunity to invade. And so I just want to go over this real quickly. Because, you know, I remember having lived there. I remember when Lukashenko first won his election in 1994, the first election. So he ran as an anti-neoliberal, anti-pro-Western reformer, anti-market reform, you know, candidate, basically as the candidate of returning as much as possible to the stability of the, you know, Soviet era, as opposed to the total chaos and mass immiseration of the post-Soviet market reforms.
Yeah.
After the first leader, Stanislav Shushkevich, you know, brought misery to the country, it was no longer popular. And Lukashenko won by a landslide, as I recall, in 1994, and kind of made good on his promise to massively restrict and pretty much snuff out what democracy they had, and also brought the state back in a huge way and did stabilize things compared to what was going on in Ukraine and Russia. I mean, Belarus's, you know, GDP per capita was a lot higher than Ukraine's up until very recently. Maybe it still is. But when he first came to power, for that reason, it was sort of, he had a mixed relationship with even Yeltsin. I'd say he had a better relationship with the Russian military and the sort of deep state. But, you know, being a basically pro-Soviet conservative, his politics were not really in line with Yeltsin's, but they had a way of dealing with each other. Yeltsin didn't want to lose Lukashenko, You know, Lukashenko made Russia, like, Lukashenko led a regime that was the most sort of Russia-friendly regime of the post-Soviet countries, where, you know, Russian was openly spoken. So they didn't want to alienate him, but they, you know, were very wary of him. And then Putin comes to power. And when Putin came to power as a liberal. We have to remember, as a, not a, necessarily a political liberal, but definitely as an economic liberal. So they're very much at odds. And one thing Lukashenko did not allow and hasn't allowed, at least up until, I don't know about the last year or two, is he has not allowed Russian oligarchs to take over assets in that country. You know, and it's a medium-sized country. Belarus is a country of about 10 million people.
Mm-hmm.
It borders Russia on its east, Poland on the west, two more NATO countries in the north, Latvia and Lithuania, and then, of course, Ukraine to the south.
Highest casualty rates of any territory in World War II.
That's right.
Just slaughtered.
Yep. And I always remember that the relationship was quite bad, even in the 2000s, in the first sort of Putin era. Lukashenko would sort of play this game where he would, you know, steal gas through transit fees and so on, and make sure he got cheaper gas without giving Russia what Russia wanted, which was more basing rights, access to Belarusian assets. But then he would sort of play a double game by saying, well, if you're going to lean on me too hard, I'm going to sort of start making friends with the West.
Mm-hmm.
And the West's attitude on and off was, well, yeah, he's a dictator, but, you know, if we could peel him away from Russia, yeah. And that has worked with some dictators.
They would have said, we've dealt with way worse.
Exactly.
And then tell some horror stories about some of our friends.
Yeah. So in 2010, there was an election. And at that time, Dmitry Medvedev was president and Putin was prime minister. And it was hard. I mean, it wasn't a secret. It was pretty open that Russia was backing the opposition to Lukashenko. And so the EU started sending diplomats and upping its relationship and trying to court Lukashenko. And Russia was backing basically kind of a color revolution, protesters there. But Russia had its own candidates, which were kind of, banker, they weren't radical in any sort of way. They were sort of gray sort of figures, right?
Right.
And, but Russian TV just ran endless stories attacking Lukashenko as a dictator for the crimes he was committing on his people, for his attacks on the opposition. And that's when, you know, the Obama administration, Michael McFaul, the EU, they saw an opportunity to make friends with this guy. But when he held the election and, you know, stole it to some degree as usual, there were protests and Lukashenko sent in his goons to beat up the protesters. That made the West kind of queasy. And so they kind of had to be quieter about how they were wooing Lukashenko, and they had to back away a bit. And also the wave of, you know, Arab Spring revolutions and color revolutions were bothering Putin, and Putin decided he was going to come back to power. And so, you know, Russia made more generous overtures to Lukashenko to bring him back into the fold. And then the Maidan revolution happens in 2014. And Lukashenko, oddly enough, supports the Maidan revolution and opposes Russia's annexation of Crimea and opposes the Donbass breaking away and becomes like a hero to Ukrainians. There was a poll in, it's either 2014 or 2015 of Ukrainians, and their favorite world leader was Lukashenko.
Because
Putin was furious about that. He wouldn't, you know, he was always trying to play a double game. He didn't want Russia to hate him, and he wanted to get the free stuff from Russia that he could. But he also worried about being so sanctioned by the West that, the West would do sort of, you know, these kind of nuclear secondary sanctions where they wouldn't be able to do business anywhere in the world, like what we're trying to do now with Russia and Belarus, where you sanction anybody who does business with them. So there was kind of a game where they were playing where there were some sanctions put on Belarus because of its human rights and democracy violations, but they weren't that bad, and they were something that Lukashenko could live with. And so Lukashenko was staking out his place again as not really in, you know, as someone independent, not fully in Putin's camp, not fully in the West camp. And, you know, 2016, again, the EU, 2015, 2016, EU starts sending envoys, announced that they're reducing sanctions. The Minsk Accords, right? The Minsk talks, mm-hmm. those are held in Minsk as part of this recognition that Lukashenko is, from the West point of view, being a good actor in the war, not taking Russia's side. And they were getting some rewards for that. And in 2020, this, at least from America, this really became a big policy move by Mike Pompeo. And Pompeo, of course, is, you know, Trump, whatever, but Pompeo is the Atlantic Council, the Hudson Institute. Yeah. I mean, he is the empire on sort of the Republican side. He's not an anti-interventionist or whatever Trump pretended to be. He doesn't even pretend that. Pompeo was making a big push with the backing of the Atlantic Council in 2020 to normalize relations with Lukashenko and to really try to peel him away from Russia. And the thinking was, I mean, what was happening, if you remember in the Trump era, NATO really scored some big, from their point of view and from the military, from the arms industry's point of view, some big successes. They got, in a very dirty way, they got Montenegro to vote to join NATO and the EU. But of course, the EU was like, yeah, right, whatever. But they did bring him into NATO. I was in the Trump era. They worked out a deal basically with Montenegro's version of Lukashenko, Milo Djukanovic. I mean, this guy had been named, you know, the top mafia don of Southern Europe. You know, big time mobster. He in the 90s, you know, ran massive smuggling operations out of Montenegro with Montenegro organized crime groups. He had been indicted in the West. He had supported Milosevic's wars. And the West eventually peeled him away and basically cut a deal with Djukanovic. You could stay in power. You can get, you know, all these charges thrown off if you abandon Milosevic. And he did. Mm-hmm. But he stayed in power. I mean, he stayed in power for about 30 years, which is still a bit longer than Lukashenko, and only gave up power a few years ago after securing, right around the same time as securing Montenegro into NATO, which NATO really wanted. It takes away an old friend of Russia's.
Serbia no longer has a coastline.
Exactly.
So,
you know, there was a precedent too, where you could go to Lukashenko and say, look, this guy's one of the biggest criminals in all of Europe, and we gave him a free pass, and he was a dictator. But he did the right thing. He joined NATO. So, you know, there is a way out for you here. And so it was conceivable. Pompeo organized a huge oil shipment in May of 2020 to Belarus from the U.S. to show that Belarus didn't have to rely completely on Russia for its oil. And then was preparing to send an ambassador there for the first time in years. And I mean, I went back and read through old materials, like, you know, the Atlantic Council was backing this right up even through the early part of the protest, because the anti-Russia lobby saw this as really important. Peeling Belarus away from Russia will kneecap Russia and also help protect Ukraine. And so then elections came around in August of 2020. And in the lead up to that, Russia was backing the most popular opponent. He was a former banker. Russia backed him in the election. And Lukashenko jailed him. And then Lukashenko started jailing all the other candidates, including Svetlana Tikhanovskaya's husband. She jailed him and made Svetlana Tikhanovskaya into kind of a heroine. And the elections happened, and Lukashenko said he won like 85% of the vote. And that was a huge mistake on his part. Whether, you know, he might have got it by putting guns up to people's heads, or maybe we don't know about something in 85%. I hugely doubt it, really support him. He did a bad rigging of the election.
Yeah.
He should have rigged
you can't,
it.
Yeah. You can't do those, you know, traditional Stalinist election results where it's 97% your favor.
Not when Western Westerners and Ukrainian groups have been training up activists, you know, legions of activists with a lot of resources, especially out of Poland, Lithuania, the National Endowment for Democracy. I think things exploded much bigger than anybody expected. There was a wellspring of just pent up. People were sick of Lukashenko after 25 years, young people in particular. And the protests were huge and violent and very well organized. And Lukashenko's power was very seriously threatened. I mean, it looked like he was really going to go because cracking down hard didn't help. And, you know, powerful people in media, in official state media, in, you know, different ministries were abandoning him. And it looked like the sort of the momentum of a usual color revolution was picking up steam. So at that point, Lukashenko reached out to Putin. I mean, he couldn't reach out to the West. The West had to abandon this plan of, you know, plan A, which was woo Lukashenko and go to plan B, which is regime change. They had a plan B, and Lukashenko really didn't. So Lukashenko had nowhere to turn. He was now beating and killing protesters. The EU and the US announced, you know, real nuclear sanctions on Belarus, totally isolating him. He could not play his game anymore of playing one side off the other. So he was completely, completely at Putin's mercy. And I read, I think it was either in a Carnegie Endowment or CNN article, how he finally went to Putin and their discussion was not, what do you need? What do I need? It was just Putin giving a list of demands of what must be fulfilled if he wants Russia's support in propping up his regime.
Oh, that makes sense. Because he screwed up his attempt to do the Western move where you fake things in a credible way, and they couldn't go along with it?
I mean, in 2019, I'll read the headline here. Just the year before, here's the headline in Reuters. Russia complains over Belarus's refusal to host airbase.
Right.
Russia said on Thursday that Belarus's refusal, this is just a year, this is 2019, Belarus's refusal to host a military airbase backed by President Vladimir Putin had been, quote, an unpleasant episode, unquote. They didn't get along. Putin hated him. So they weren't going to have any kind of lovey-dovey talk. It was going to be a mob talk, you know.
Right.
Here's what I need. It wasn't even going to be like Polly. Like, well, what do I know about running Belarus? I don't know anything about it. It was more like, I know what I want.
Yeah.
And he backed up this very unpopular leader and propped him up and successfully propped him up. And Lukashenko had nowhere to turn. So Lukashenko is Putin's bitch. For the first time in his 25 years, he is. He has to do what Putin says or he's done. And what does that mean? In Putin's mind, it's not just the airbase that he gets. In Putin's mind, so completely securing Lukashenko personally as a vassal, it's not going to last forever. And it's an opportunity to get everything you want. Happened to coincide, if you remember our discussions with Leonid Rogozin, Ben Aris, and others, the fall of 2020 coincides with the time when Biden's going to take over as president. And the Zelensky regime, or whatever government, whatever you call it, was making this big shift from trying to get a peace deal, or at least, you know, making overtures. I mean, he was elected on a peace platform with Russia in 2019, and he was shifting from that to a much more aggressive, hawkish stance towards Russia, that there's no way to do a deal with Russia, and we're going to take back our lands however we can, backed by the U.S., because the Biden administration is coming in, and they're going to back this big white paper put out by, you know, the Atlantic Council. So all this is coming together at the same time. Another thing that happens, I shouldn't forget this one interesting episode too. About, I don't know, I want to say a couple weeks before the election, a few weeks before the Belarus election in the summer of 2020, Lukashenko announced that he arrested scores of Russian Wagner mercenaries who he accused of being sent to Minsk to Russia to overthrow
from
him
Russia.
In a coup. Yeah, from Russia, yeah. I'm sorry. From Russia by Putin to overthrow him in a coup.
And I remember that, and it was an absurdly small group. Like, how are you going to do this with a country that has an army, has a pretty formidable security apparatus? It didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, you know, now that I think about it, it kind of reminds me of Dukanovich in Montenegro, just on the eve of his election. He said that there were a few Russian mercenaries with Serbs sent to kill him. I don't know if you remember this. And
no.
That helped tip the vote a little bit in favor. It wasn't actually a majority, but it was a plurality in favor of a referendum that said they wanted to join NATO and the EU, but of course only got NATO. It's actually a lot of symmetry there. It turns out that Wagner group that was arrested, so he arrested them, jailed them, tortured them. He genuinely believed it because he's had this bad relationship with Russia all this time. And eventually he understood that something else was going on. And certainly by the time, you know, this huge protest movement broke out and, you know, the West was obviously supportive of it and backing it. Not that it wasn't a real organic protest movement too, but had huge backing on various levels from the West, from Poland, from Lithuania, from the U.S. Eventually what we discovered was, and this broke out later, months later, that Wagner group had been, it was part of a plot hatched by Ukraine's secret services with CIA or U.S. intelligence backing, where they were going to try to lure a whole bunch of Russian soldiers into Ukraine and arrest them to hold big show trials for propaganda purposes and maybe to also to heat things up, right?
And to smooth the way for much bigger funding from the U.S. Yeah.
And so what they did was they put ads in, various Russian media targeted at military veterans and mercenaries and that whole world for a big gig, I think something to do with Turkey. And they wound up getting all these guys, and then they'd interview them over the internet. They'd interview all these guys and get from them, and these guys would spill the beans and boast about everything they were involved in. So they were basically giving testimony to what would be their trials of everything they were guilty of.
Yeah.
And then they were put on a plane. The only way to get them to Turkey, they figured, was, and not, you know, raise alarm bells, was have them fly on a charter jet from Moscow to Minsk, and then Minsk to Istanbul. And what they were going to do was then the Ukrainian Air Force was going to force the plane down over Ukraine airspace, which is what Lukashenko learned and what he did when he later forced the airplane down with the Belarusian nationalist Roman Protasevich, I think his name was, Azov guy, right? Which led to all kinds of sanctions, and we've never had air piracy like this before. This was a plot that was, again, according to CNN, that was worked out with the CIA. So they got them in the charter jet, somehow got away with it, flew them into Minsk, and then at the Minsk airport, somebody tipped them off. I'm not sure who or how, but they were tipped off. And there were some others, there were a few others already in Belarus. There were, I think, supposedly there were a total of maybe up to 200 Wagner mercenaries, but several dozens on this airplane. And they were all rounded up and jailed. And, and Lukashenko was convinced. I mean, maybe Western Ukrainian intelligence dropped that. As soon as they arrested, they had a backup plan to just say, oh, this is a Russian coup operation. That plan, so anyway, the real plot was found out. And it was leaked because Ukraine had, up until the invasion this year, a very active and very factionalized media, like a great media, sort of like Russia's in the 90s, great investigative media. And it turned out that it turned into something called Wagnergate in 2021. Mm-hmm. And as Ukrainian media and the Ukrainian state and Zelensky tried to get to the bottom of it, at different times, Zelensky basically said, I never had any inkling of this. Like Ukrainian intelligence, I guess the CIA, did this all behind my back. I never approved of this. And then somebody really powerful would say, yes, you did, God damn it. And then he'd say, well, maybe I did. And then he'd backtrack again and say, this was basically a coup plot by the previous president that he defeated, Poroshenko, who's very close with Western military and intelligence agencies and very tight with Ukrainian nationalists and all the Ukrainian nationalists within their, security and military structures. And Zelensky said, this is a coup plot by Poroshenko to overthrow me using Wagnergate and all of this. Somehow it was all part of like an elaborate coup plot. And he at one point even implicated an oligarch and implicated parts of the FSB. And it got really wild. But it is pretty clear. And then he also issued an arrest warrant for Poroshenko, the previous president. The Maidan Revolution president, Poroshenko, had an arrest warrant. And he was kept in house arrest, along with the pro-Russian oligarch, Medvedchuk. Zelensky was cracking down on all opposition at this point in the year leading up to Russia's invasion. But my point is this, getting back to Belarus. Before August of 2020, Russia could not have invaded. Putin could not have invaded from Belarus. And that means before August 2020, and before the U.S.-backed protest, regime change, basically, movement, before August 2020, Putin could not have done the invasion plan that he did, which was all centered on doing a lightning strike to take Kyiv. You couldn't have done that lightning
strike. From Belarus.
From Belarus, right. It had, right. But you couldn't have planned a lightning invasion on Kyiv from Russia, from the Russian border. Right. There's no way. I mean, it's all so we see
right,
what's going on
Kyiv
on the border.
Right, because Kyiv is at the northern edge, more or less. And borders Belarus, right?
Well, and all the well dug in defenses, and the Russians knew about, at the very least, about all the trench works and so on that the Ukrainians had set up in the on the borders with Russia in that region. It would have been next to him. Put it this way: it would have been extremely difficult. It would not have been what appeared to be a very easy, a much more easy operation. It wouldn't have been a 50-mile. Race. It would have been hundreds of miles. So my point is that, and this has been completely forgotten, if not for the regime change, sanctions and the U.S. and the West, for better or for worse, you could say they had every right to do it and so on and so forth. But this is one of those unintended consequences that pushed, Lukashenko completely into Putin's arms. That allowed Putin, we could talk about him being isolated. We could talk about the twinkle in his eye. We could talk about all, his face looked weird. He's on steroids. He has cancer, whatever the hell's going on, legacy. But he actually had an opportunity for once.
Right.
To decapitate in his mind. He thought he had a real opportunity Now that the head, you know, the capo of Belarus owed him, he had an opportunity to do a decapitation strike on Kyiv to reverse the whole Maidan revolution thing and put Russia in a much better position. And he knew
all, it sounds like it worked really well and quickly in Belarus. And, you know, Lukashenko is a pretty formidable guy. So if you could do that in Belarus so easily, you'd be strutting.
And he propped up Assad, and he propped up Tokayev you know, there were huge protests in Kazakhstan, and it's kind of an interesting contrast here. So Kazakhstan had huge anti-government protests at the beginning of 2022. We did an episode on it in the beginning of the year. And Tokayev is essentially a dictator, and he took over from Nazarbayev, who was a dictator, backed by the West because Chevron makes bank there and the Iranian companies make bank. And he does a good, you know, the leaders there have done a good job of not making enemies with Russia, China, or America, trying to be friendly and keep everybody happy. And this is an instance where the West sees it in its realpolitik interest not to highlight the human rights crimes and to, you know, scream and cry and tear the bloody shirt about all the people that he kills, and they've killed lots of people, but instead to maintain stability. So, you know, when Tokayev, the leader of Kazakhstan, looked like he potentially might fall, we didn't even know who the forces were behind the protesters. They were, some of them were organized and armed. It could have been the previous dictator, Nazarbayev's forces. It could have been a coup. Putin sent in forces there and pretty quickly propped up the regime. You know, the only real complaint from Blinken in the West was, I think what he famously said was, when you invite in the Russians, they never leave. You know, they left. You know, yes. I mean, America should talk.
Yeah, but, so he would have seemed to be on a roll, and part of this role would have meant placing his forces with a newly compliant Lukashenko within what seemed like easy striking distance of Kyiv. And as you say, that makes a lot more sense in explaining what seemed from the outside like an idiotic invasion plan than, you know, doing this analysis of Putin as Mr. Burns doing Howard Hughes.
And you know, again, I mean, like, I feel like there might be something to all that, but it's just such mushy thinking. Like, what is much more concrete is, yeah, he actually had an opportunity. We've forgotten, or we buried the fact that we were wooing Belarus. Lukashenko, this guy who we've gone back and forth over the years. You know, we've forgotten that he was in play up until August 2020, and he was no longer in play by policy of the West. And so this is like, so Putin's belief that he could do this lightning invasion and take Kyiv is an unintended consequence of a failed regime change, of a failed Western regime change, you know, movement in Belarus.
That's a great point.
Yeah. I mean, you can get, like, you can start really overthinking this and think, you know, oh, but maybe the West knew all along what it was doing. It was suckering Putin into the invasion. Or maybe Putin was so brilliant, he knew what he was doing. He actually let the protest go up because, you know, cui bono, Putin won out from those protests. Putin wound up getting everything from, so maybe Putin was actually secretly luring the West into backing that protest movement. That's all like stupid, funny talk too. I think the surface is interesting and wild enough here. Like, Putin had an opportunity because a regime change operation went bad and forced Lukashenko to owe his life to Putin. And Putin then got it into his head, the biggest thing I need before I go, or whatever, while I still have time, is to get rid of the pro-NATO Maidan regime and put in somebody friendlier to Russia. And it was a stupid calculation. But
when you think of it from his perspective, and given the record he'd had with these successes in other places in Central Asia and Western, well, Eastern Europe, Southeastern Europe. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. All right.
It makes more sense, I think, is a better way to put it, right? It makes more sense, I think, yeah. All right, so let's take a quick break, listen to some music from Brendan Anderegg, and then come back and finish up our end of the year episode. Okay, we're back. That was music, and I'll post links again because we get asked to sometimes music by Brendan Anderegg, our sound engineer, also a great musician. I mean, the music you put on, I told you a couple episodes ago, I was just like mesmerized by it, Brendan.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyways, yeah, so we want to wrap up the year right now. We've gone on for a while. I think we just wanted to make a couple more points before we
I mentioned the defense budget, the U.S. defense budget just came in, and I think it deserves a show of its own. After all, when you're talking about something that's going to add up to $1 trillion, it deserves at least a 90-minute podcast, if not more than that. I just want to highlight the fact that you're in this grotesque situation where the Biden administration, supposedly the liberal wing of United States politics, if there is one, is getting criticized by a former Reagan administration official and vice president of Raytheon, a guy named Lawrence Korb, complaining, nobody seems to want to make the tough decisions. The trillion dollar defense budget, that's where we're headed. Even the Democrats now seem to be afraid to be seen as being soft on defense. So we're going to talk, and we'll have to save this for the coming year, about how we got to the $1 trillion defense budget after the Cold War ended, and how the poor threatened defense budget sustained itself in those lean years when there weren't plausible demons on the horizon. I think it's worth a show in itself, but we'll hold off for that.
Yeah, maybe we can get Andrew Coburn back on for that. But I mean, bringing that up, John, I just two headlines here and then we'll move on. New York Times headline from 2 days ago, the 18th. Military spending surges, creating new boom for arms makers. Subheader. I know. The combination of the war in Ukraine and concern about longer-term threats from Russia and China. Longer-term threats from Russia. Still working on Bakhmut. I think they, you know, they might get four more streets in the next year. longer-term threats from Russia and China is driving a bipartisan push to increase U.S. capacity to produce weapons. What did they rolled out that B-21?
We have to talk about the B-21, but we don't really have time to do it today. It's just, it's extraordinary that Ukraine, which was the most dramatic imaginable demonstration of the utter incompetence of the Russian armed forces, has somehow morphed into another reason to increase the U.S. defense budget.
Speaking of Ukraine, and this is the last I'll say on this topic, but let's keep this in mind for when we come back to it. This is a story in Reuters, February 24th, 2014. The headline, budget cuts to slash U.S. Army to smallest since before World War II. The date, February 24th, 2014. What happens within days of this? Maidan Revolution, Russia taking Crimea. Suddenly, those budget cuts are out the window, and it's party time again in North Virginia. Who'd have thunk? What are the odds, you know? My God.
Baby, we're getting that pool.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. And just before we go, because I just put this in there, and I watched these, and I didn't like watching them, most of them. I just wanted to say I went through a brief sort of binge of watching some war movies. I haven't seen the new Top Gun, and I really don't want to see it.
I don't want to see it either.
I know. And I don't like Tom Cruise, okay? Yeah. But I did watch a few movies on the streaming channels that, have been out there. The first one, which I never saw, I was supposed to see it when it first came out and I was still in New York City. They Shall Not Be Forgotten, the Peter Jackson, recovering all the World War I footage, right? I was supposed to see it when it came out in New York City, and that day the subway was stopped because a power station near my house blew up for some reason. Surprised they didn't blame Russians for that. But so I didn't see it.
No, it was
then.
A compassionate God preventing you from saying Peter Jackson's World War I little obsession.
I would only say this. It was nice of him to do it, to not forget them, I guess. Yeah. It wasn't a particularly, I don't see what the big deal was about. It wasn't particularly great, but it was... It's interesting seeing, older, silent movie, Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton movie people slowed down and colorized. I don't know what else you can say, but don't forget him. All Quiet in the Western Front, a new version. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of World War I stuff here. Mm-hmm. So there's a new German version on that they started showing on Netflix. And it reminded me now why. So it's okay. But it reminded me.
I watched some of that too, and I had to stop because, I don't have as strong a stomach as I used to.
Oh, because of all the gore, the war.
Yeah,
gore? Yeah, it's pretty gory. I know, and I remember the book kind of being like that.
Yes,
but it reminded me of two things about the book. like why it had an impact on me. And I remember my father, who was a big militarist, and he told me he saw that movie and said, fuck the military, I'm going civilian. And the reason is because all the propaganda, everything I'd read glorified war before then. I mean, I read a lot of World War II books when I was a little kid and some Civil War and some other stuff, and they all made war, you know, bloody but glorious. And this mm-hmm. was the first book, and it's not the best anti-war book. It's good. It's not bad. It's pretty damn melodramatic. It takes place towards the end. And of course, on the last day, when the armistice has already been signed, you know, the most melodramatic stuff already happens to bring the point home that war is stupid. It's a bit cheesy in that way. You know, not bad. I wouldn't watch it again. Let's see. There was a series on HBO, Hostages, about when Iran took the hostages. It's just crap. I don't know. It's absolute crap. I was actually pissed off. I couldn't watch much of it. It's sort of like, I don't know. It's just, it reminds you how grotesquely elite that top layer of the U.S. media is and how incestuous they are. And they're just, it was just gross. I didn't like it at all. It didn't get down to what was visceral about that. Yeah. A Korean movie called The Front Line.
That's Chosen. The Chosen?
Nope. 38th Parallel as the armistice. And then, of course, it has its own heroes dying after the armistice finally is signed sort of thing because war is bad. It's not that good. It's kind of a lesser All Quiet on the Western Front. I mean, as a rule, all these ones, there are some other ones I can't remember, but these are the ones off the top of my head. You know, to quote that Grinch song, the three words for you are as follows, and I quote, stink, stank, stunk. That's kind of how I feel. Sorry. But there was one really good one on HBO. If you want grim war, like hard reality grim war, this movie, at least for me, I thought it was, because I hadn't seen a movie, a genuine anti-war movie made like this before. It's called War Torn, 1861 to 2010. And it's all about the history of PTSD, of young suckers going into war, how prevalent PTSD is, and how prevalent suicide is. And there's no even hint of glory in it. It's good. It starts off with...
I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
Where do you see it?
HBO.
Okay.
Grim, I gotta see that. Really grim. And it was made in 2010. This is... Wow. I gotta admit, I normally would never want to watch something like that. Like, I feel like, yeah, I like a good blood and guts or even an anti-war movie. But this is the grim shit. This is just about psychological damage and people returning to their families. And it's, you know, documentary, nonfiction. And if you know anybody who has a dumb idea of getting into war and you want to show them something to dissuade them, show them this.
War Torn. All
War
right,
Torn,
HBO.
1861 to 2010 is the name, yeah. And so I think we can end on that really wretched, grim note.
All right.
Another grim war year, 2022 closes.
Yeah, but you know, the good news is, and I know it's not my place to bring up good news, but we did our job this year.
Yes,
when I looked over those episodes, I think, we did our job.
We did our job, and, you know, it's all thanks to the great Radio Warner community, to subscribers. Yeah. Seriously, without whom, God only knows. I don't even want to think about it without whom.
No, don't bear thinking about.
No.
I don't think I'd be here, but yeah.
Yeah. So thank you to everybody for another great, grim and great year. And talk to you at the beginning of next year. Happy holidays.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.